There's one country on which the European Union has been pinning its hopes, China. Twice in the last 2 weeks, European leaders have asked China for major financial help. NPR Shanghai correspondent Frank Langfitt has been tracking China's reaction and joins us now. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Audie.
So what role could China play in beefing up the EU's bailout fund?
Well, I think the EU is looking for as much money at this point that they can get out of China. And the reason they're going to China is China has more foreign currency reserves than anybody else, primarily because of the enormous exports that they put out there. It's $3.2 trillion they have. And they're looking for whatever they can get, in terms of the EU. Now, China has been really careful. They haven't given any numbers, they've made no commitments, and they've really kind of downplayed expectations. And one reason is there's so much uncertainty around the EU right now. As you remember, just a few days ago, the prime minister there in Greece was talking about a national referendum on the debt plan, which rattled everybody. And the Chinese have also made it very clear that if they're going to do anything, they want some kind of insurance against big losses. They've already been criticized in the past for putting so much money into U.S. treasuries, and they don't want more of that kind of backlash here back home in China.
Frank, how does the Chinese public feel about this?
Well, it hasn't been a big topic of conversation, I think, generally on the streets. But if you go on the internet, you go to Chinese Twitter, which is called Weibo, it's been pretty negative. China's the second largest economy right now in the world. It's a huge country, though, with 1.3 billion people. So the per capita income is really a small fraction of what you'd see in most Western European countries. So a lot of the comments have been running along class lines. And I just want to read one to you here. It goes, quote, "The Chinese have no retirement money, cannot afford to see a doctor, can't afford to buy apartments. What about Europe? People don't go to work. They enjoy a good life. Poor people lend money to rich guys. This is just absurd."
So how are the country's leaders handling that level of criticism?
Right now they're being very careful to sort of say, we're not going to do a whole lot here. We're going to be very, very careful, that Europe really has to get its house in order. They've been very critical of the EU. But the government here does pay attention, even though it is a dictatorship. They do pay attention to public opinion. They poll frequently. There are a lot of public protests in this country. And that comment that I just read to you kind of gets to a disconnect between sort of how the world sees China these days compared to how ordinary Chinese people see themselves. From the outside, this is an amazing economy. It's still going at 9.4%, even though it's slowing down. And if you look in my neighborhood, you will see a BMWs and Bentleys on the street. But if you look on the side of the streets, you'll see these little shops where people really feel like they're struggling. They're dealing with 6% inflation. They'll often work until 9, 10, 11 at night, selling fruit and cooking food. They have to sleep in their stores. So the idea of extending money to the EU is just not that appealing.
If China does provide help to the EU, I can't imagine that's going to be a no-strings-attached proposition.
No, not at all. In fact, I think in some ways the Chinese leadership may see this as a really great opportunity to sort of show their power and influence globally. No one's ever really come to them quite like this before. One of the things they've made it very clear that they want is to be designated a full market economy by the EU. And that sounds kind of esoteric, but it is important. This would make it harder for European firms to bring trade cases against Chinese companies. That would be good for Chinese companies in terms of exporting, but would probably put some European firms at something of a disadvantage. Generally, people expect that China will do something here. The EU is its largest export market, so it has a self-interest in helping. But right now, it's kind of enjoying positive press. There have been a lot of stories that have sort of been framed as, can China save the EU? And China's repeatedly said no, especially for public consumption. But the question only enhances the perception of power of the country here. And I think probably from the government's perspective, that's a really good thing.
NPR Shanghai correspondent Frank Langfitt. Frank, thanks so much.
Happy to do it, Audie.
On Murray Fisher's 81st birthday, he gave his daughter, Karen Fisher Alanese, a gift of sorts, more than 400 pages of letters he had written to his parents while serving in World War II. Karen spent nearly a decade sifting through the letters and uncovering her father's past. And she learned something she never knew about him. Murray Fisher was part of a secret intelligence group in the Navy, trained to break Japanese codes transmitted in katakana during the war. Karen's discovery, her father's memories, and the lingering trauma of his wartime experiences are the basis for her new book, Breaking the Code, A Father's Secret, A Daughter's Journey, and the Question That Changed Everything. I spoke with Karen Fisher Alanese and her father, Murray Fisher, from Walla Walla, Washington, this past week. I asked Murray if he had a reason for holding on to his secret for so long.
Well, not especially. Of course, I was brainwashed from right at the start to not reveal any of this information ever. So I think my brain just said, don't talk. So I didn't.
I think it also got tied up in he experienced a great loss of one of his friends during the war, and he just wasn't able to talk about it.
Murray, was there a time when you wanted Karen to stop looking into these letters, especially like when nightmares returned and things like that? I mean, did you feel as though it was dredging up too much?
No, I didn't feel that way. I didn't feel good about it, but I didn't feel bad either. It was kind of hard to describe. I didn't want to stop. I didn't want her to forget the whole thing.
But he would shut down. I mean, he'd reveal so much, and you got a feeling there was more. But then, you know, should I ask more about this? Should I tell him what I found in the letters? I mean, different things like that. During this whole time, he would not read the letters. Even when we were transcribing them, we would do them in bits and pieces.
And you transcribed, 400 pages of letters.
Yeah, he has this teeny, teeny, tiny writing. So I needed help. There's military jargon. There's language that was used in the 1940s. And then just his handwriting, trying to decipher what he was writing.
One thing I found interesting, Karen, is that there is a generational difference in terms of, I think people in our generation tend to think that sharing and talking things out is the way to heal. And I wonder what that was like for you and your dad to adjust between that different point of view of not talking about something versus really wanting to talk about every bit of it.
Well, at first it was very awkward. I mean, at first I wanted to just say, tell me about the war. Tell me how you're feeling about this, like you're saying. But that's not something that this generation did. I mean, when he came home from the war, he hung up his uniform and that was it. They went back to their normal everyday life. So that whole story would have remained untold.
Murray, how did you feel about that?
Well, it was just all right with me. I had nothing to talk about, especially, except I was in the Navy and I came out and I was okay. And we were sworn to secrecy about everything I did. One of the meetings we went to, a sergeant in there laid a sidearm down on the desk and with a clunk And he said, if any of you talk about this to any of your friends and word gets out that you did this, you'll be put in solitary confinement for the duration of the war at hard labor. If you say anything that reveals top secret information that's of advantage to the enemy, he said, you'll be shot. You'll be shot and there'll be no trial. We'll allow you to go on liberty, but if you go out in a tavern for having a beer, you're up at the bar and somebody sitting beside you there, you can be assured that he's one of our operatives. He was so emphatic about it that it scared the daylights out of us, and I don't think any of us ever said a word. A couple of years after I got out of the service, a couple of men came up to the door. They had black suits on and shiny black shoes, and I thought they were going to preach me a sermon or something, but it turned out they said, you're now released from the secrecy of this one thing, but the other, what you were doing, you can't, that's not released. That's never been released so far. As far as I know, someone might come up in this room and shoot me because I've been talking about it. I guess it's okay at this stage.
It seems okay at this stage, but have you both been able to learn any more detail or corroborate these stories with military records?
No, nothing at all.
Well, to some extent. I mean, I did have someone who was helping me who had 26 years in naval intelligence, and I sent records to him, and he looked at them, and he said, although there's not anything specific, he said that just looking at the locations, he was able to see that he was where he said he was. He said there are definitely some blank areas in there. So in that sense, yes, but no. I mean, Dad is a very methodical person. He has an incredible memory, and it kind of drives him crazy that he can't just get verification of this. Just get a sheet of paper that says this is what you're doing, you know. He would love that, but it doesn't seem to be out there.
Karen Fisher Alanese and her father, Murray Fisher. His story is the focus of Karen's new book, Breaking the Code, A Father's Secret, A Daughter's Journey, and The Question That Changed Everything. They joined us from Walla Walla, Washington. Thank you both so much for sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Now, for the occupiers, it may be all about the Benjamins. But what happens when you use real money to buy imaginary things? It's happening every day on Facebook. People are paying to buy things for pretend farms and cities, thanks to Zynga, a virtual goods company. This industry took in $9 billion real dollars last year alone from consumers buying tractors and buildings that don't exist. Now Zynga is going public with an IPO expected in the next few weeks, and Zynga is trying hard to get ahead of the game by dropping millions of dollars on a few new games, including Castleville. NPR's Arthi Shahani set off to understand the market value of a business built on nothing.
We'll start with the tour of Piskorskyville. It's a bustling city full of stores, row houses, and red brick condos. A policeman patrols downtown, waving his baton. Northeast, there's a small community garden.
I forgot to come back to my city, so some of my plants have withered away, and my friends actually have been kind enough to come back and unwither some of my plants.
That's Meshek Piskorsky, the city's namesake. But city is a slight misnomer. Piskorskyville doesn't really exist. Or one could say it totally does, on his computer screen. Meshek is sitting in his office at Harvard Business School. He's a professor. His job? To play and study popular online games like Cityville by Zynga. Meshek harvests his virtual crop and sells to a local grocer. Not for cash, at least not the green folding type. His money, like his goods, are virtual. But for 5% of Zynga's 200 million monthly users, that's not the case.
You can buy a special currency, and you can use it in two ways. You can spend it on speeding up certain processes or getting some functionalities that are available to you that are not available to others. But you can also spend the currency on beautifying the city.
Luxury condos, yachts, they won't have a use.
But they will be just really beautiful to look at.
Zynga raked in $1 billion in sales this last year. That's $1 billion U.S. dollars, the green folding type. In sales of virtual tractors that plow virtual farms, or avatars that make gamers just a bit more beautiful to look at. 19-year-old Tiara Kate sells Zynga currency at a CVS in Washington, D.C. She points to a shelf lined with prepaid cards, Starbucks, Lowe's Theater, and one with a goofy duck waddling up a pasture. That's for Farmville, Zynga's mega hit.
I've seen kids come in with their parents and cry for these cards, or older people, like between late 30, early 40, a lot of them buy the Farmville cards.
Why are you laughing? Why is it funny?
Because my dad does it too, and I think it's like ridiculous. I think it's, say it's a $20 gift card. When it's gone, you'll be buying another one.
That's exactly the point. Traditional video games make you pay up front. Zynga inverted the model. Play for free, and once you're hooked, pay to get ahead. Zynga officials declined an interview because, they said, they're in a quiet period required by the Securities and Exchange Commission before the IPO. Eric Ries, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Lean Startup, is a Zynga fan. Or, to be more precise, a critic of the critics. To those who say virtual goods aren't real,
I don't think that you're using the word real correctly. What is real?
Fashionistas spend $2,000 on a Prada handbag. Gamers spend $20 on an imaginary tractor or avatar or sword. Same difference. Except,
unlike in the physical world, the virtual objects are all tied to the specific environment in which they were developed. So if you have a sword in a game like World of Warcraft, you can't take that sword with you into the real world, but you also can't take it with you into other games.
The Zynga IPO is a test of whether this new thing, the virtual good, is durable.
Maybe just it's a fad.
That's Sam Hamada, CEO of Privco. He sifts through the financial data of private corporations. He estimates Zynga is worth $5 billion. Others say $20 billion. Ironically, it comes down to whether competitors buy into the business model.
Now that they've shown the way, the question is, will traditional gaming companies like Electronic Arts, like Activision, you know, will Disney then start offering games based on its characters in the same model?
Zynga broke the curse of online businesses. It kicked the addiction to ad revenue, the bane of the web. The ads it does have enhanced the game. American Express sponsors blue virtual windmills that help grow crops. Lady Gaga sexed up the scene by releasing her album Born This Way on Gagaville. Zynga's IPO will now test whether the company's modern-day alchemy, turning virtual goods into real money, is a game-changer for the gaming industry. Aarti Shahani, NPR News.
It's weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan. 2 years, 30,000 stories, and 6 winners.
Hi, it's Danielle Evans. I can't wait to come back next week and tell you who the winner of the 3-Minute Fiction Contest is.
You heard right. Next week, our judge will be here to announce the winner of round 7 of our 3-Minute Fiction Contest. Now, for those of you catching the tail end of this round, 3-Minute Fiction is this program's creative writing contest where our listeners submit an original short story that can be read in about 3 minutes. This time around, we enlisted the help of award-winning writer Daniel Evans, author of the short story collection Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self. And I am pretty sure Danielle's busy reading that last batch of stories we just sent her. In the meantime, we thought it'd be cool to catch up with the previous winners of each round, so we put our producer, Kenya Young, on a mission to find out where they are now. And Kenya, what did you find out?
Yeah, Lori, you know, it actually has been really cool to catch up with these winners. Going all the way back to the first round, it's really hard to believe that we've been doing this for 2 years.
That's right, because the first round launched back in June of 2009, right?
Yeah, really, this is just something we decided to do for a little bit of summer fun. And we had no idea at all that it would get this much attention and get as big as it did. Here we are, 7 rounds later.
And James Wood was the judge of that first round?
Yeah, he was. And in fact, we didn't even have a challenge at that point. With round 1, it was just an open-ended contest. The listeners just had to write a story in under 600 words. So you can imagine all the different stories that came in.
A lot of different stories. But one that caught James Wood's eye was...
Not That I Care by Molly Reed. And I caught up with her yesterday.
I'm applying to some writing residencies and conferences and just really concentrating my efforts there, which is kind of scary, but was a necessary change, I think.
Molly just moved to Portland, Oregon, and she's actually working on a collection of short stories. Now, I don't know if you remember, but Molly's story back in round 1 was about animals, ducks, in fact. And ever since then, she's just kept writing about animals.
I have recently written about some Freudian hummingbirds. In one of my stories, I have a severed cat paw and a murdered hamster.
Wait a minute, a severed cat paw and a murdered hamster.
I know. I said the same thing, and I had to have Molly explain.
I've just found myself really fascinated with the animal-human relationship, and it's not really about the animals themselves so much as sort of how we use animals, you know, as substitutes for our relationships or as symbols or talismans, and how that sort of reveals an important part of us.
Okay, so James Wood also judged round 2 of the contest, but that time he added a twist.
So yeah, round 2 is the first time where we actually started giving the writers a challenge, some kind of criteria that they had to meet within these 600 words. So for example, in round 2, every story had to begin with the first line, "The nurse left work at 5 o'clock." And the winner of that round was Kathy Formusa with the story Last Scene.
What's Kathy up to these days?
So she's still writing since winning the contest. In fact, she's working on a novel. And she's had this novel in her head for years, and she said 3-Minute Fiction kind of helped her get it out and be more committed to writing it. But Kathy is also a full-time massage therapist out in Port Townsend, Washington. So she's just having a hard time finding the time to actually complete her novel.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely takes longer to write a novel than a 3-minute story, I would imagine.
That's exactly what Rhonda Strickland said. She is actually the winner from round 3. Her winning story was Please Read, and it was chosen by writer and book critic Alan Chuse. And I actually think Alan would be really thrilled to know that Rhonda is working on her memoir.
Really?
Yeah, she's writing about overcoming humble roots, and her parents were the children of sharecroppers, and Rhonda herself actually grew up right outside of D.C. here in the first prefabricated housing development. The funny thing is, Rhonda actually lives in North Carolina now, and she's a tutor, and she says that winning 3-Minute Fiction actually increased her tutoring clientele. Apparently, when parents hear that she's one of the 3-Minute Fiction winners, they think they're getting a real bargain when they hire her to tutor their kids.
You're kidding.
It's too funny.
So what about the others? We have Yoav Ben-Yosef, round 4, Zach Brockhaus of round 5, and Laurie Anderson winning the last round, round 6.
Yeah, you know, all of them. I had really great talks with all 3 of them. And what I love about our past winners is that they're just so humble.
I got this just overwhelming response from all the people that knew me from school and all my friends. And it was really nice and kind of embarrassing.
That's Yoav Ben-Yosef, winner of round 4, as we mentioned. Writer Ann Patchett chose his story, Not Calling Attention to Ourselves.
And did Yoav say winning 3-Minute Fiction helped him in any way?
To say the least.
Actually, the co-chair of a college became quite a mentor to me and hired me to teach. And I was also contacted by an agent, and I've been working with her. And it's been really helpful to be able to have somebody sort of on the other side waiting for a story, because that gave me the drive to keep writing, which actually is exactly what Anne said that she hoped would happen from the experience, that I would kind of like regain some faith in my writing, which I have.
And I tell you, Laura, it seems like folks are really paying attention to this contest, the little contest that could, because agents contacted Zach Brockhaus and Laurie Anderson as well.
A lot of literary agents follow 3-Minute Fiction, so that was a surprising place where I got a lot of interest.
That's Zach Brockhaus. He was the winner of round 5, which was judged by the wonderful Michael Cunningham.
When I won the contest, I wasn't quite prepared for what was going to happen. I didn't have a lot of finished material like I do now. I've been writing pretty consistently since the contest, and I've actually just sent out my first 2 stories at the end of September. I plan on sending out another batch here pretty soon.
And you said Laurie Anderson, the winner of round 6, was contacted by agents as well?
Yeah, I was even taken aback by all that's happened to Laurie since Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie selected her story as the winner less than just 6 months ago.
After winning, I had 3 different short stories published in literary journals and 2 poems. And I was named the Tobias Wolf Award in Fiction.
Really?
The Bellingham Review, which is a great journal. So that was super exciting.
That's pretty extraordinary. And to think we'll soon be adding another winner into the mix.
That's right. Who knows what's going to be in store for that person after Danielle makes her announcement next week. But they're going to really be in some good company.
That's producer Kenya Young. She pretty much runs all things 3-Minute Fiction around these parts. And you can keep up with her and others on our 3-Minute Fiction Facebook page. Don't forget to check out the stories posted so far on our website at npr.org/3-Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. And tune in next week for a special visit from the regular host of this show, Guy Raz, and our judge, Daniel Evans, for our Round 7 winner reveal.
Playing high school football is a rite of passage for many American teens. In Southern California, the game has taught one sophomore and his teammates that in life, there are all kinds of victories. Gloria Hillard brings us the story from the small town of Acton.
It's afternoon practice for Vasquez High's junior varsity football team. A high desert wind somersaults a discarded paper plate across the line of scrimmage just before it becomes a pile of white jersey and purple helmets.
Bobby, you're offside.
The players dust themselves off and line up for the next play. At center is Taylor Howell, a lean 15-year-old. His quarterback is a few yards behind him in shotgun formation.
Down! Set! Hot! Good.
That good from the quarterback is valuable information for Taylor. It means his aim was dead on. Taylor, the team's center, is blind.
You know, breaking out of the huddle, you know, after he calls the play, you know, it's up to my guards to get me up to the line of scrimmage, make sure that I know where the ball is.
Down! Set! Hut!
Quarterback Brian McCauley takes it from there.
On the field, the tackles tell him what to do, and like if he has a question, he comes to me, and I make sure he's straight so he doesn't snap the ball crooked.
Head coach Tim Jorgensen says initially he played Taylor as center just for extra point.
Because that's somewhat of a protected position. You can't hit him because their heads are down, and he's an excellent snapper. And about a couple of games in, the coach says, well, he wants to play regular. And I said, put him in there.
Ready? Good drink. Get back.
During the water break, Taylor takes off his helmet. He has short, light brown hair and a no-nonsense demeanor. But when I ask him about the practice, if he took any hits, his face lights up.
I've taken a few hard ones. You know, it happens. It's part of football.
You take the hits as they come, Taylor says, something he learned at a very young age. He was just a toddler when he was diagnosed with cancer. After a year of radiation and chemotherapy, he lost both of his eyes.
We've never discouraged him from doing anything he's wanted to do.
Taylor's mom, Jennifer Odekirk, says her son learned the alphabet in Braille when he was just in preschool.
He's always been a little ahead of his time, which has been amazing. He is a daily inspiration for me.
Teammate Hector Hernandez remembers when Taylor told him he was going to try out for football.
And, like, I didn't think he would actually do it, but, like, he's pretty tough. Like, he gets banged up every day, and he's, like, he's just still hanging in there.
The players don't cut their center any slack, but they're watching out for him all the time, whether it's a gentle tug on his jersey or verbal cues, a step forward, a little to the right.
Ready.
It's more than 2 hours into practice. The sun is setting behind the hills, and those white jerseys are more a shade of dirt and grass now. Taylor says he plans to try out for varsity next year and has talked to Coach Jorgensen about playing college ball.
And I'm realistic with him. I said, well, you know, you're going to grow. And as you get strong and you got to lift weights and we need to get your strength up. And as we get into that, we'll see. We'll take it one step at a time, 1 year at a time.
That's good enough for Taylor. For now, he's focused on winning the next game.
That's a feeling you can't describe, you know, after you come off the field knowing that you helped your team just win or, you know.
After the dust settles, a tall guard with wide shoulders gently guides his center back to the offensive line. For NPR News, I'm Gloria Hillard.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.